to roll the tape. The media ministry is listening. My name is Mark Schwain, and I'm serving the village this summer as one of the teaching staff coordinators, the other one sitting immediately to my right, though tonight she's in a slightly different role. Forums, for those of you who haven't been at Holden Forums before, represent a long tradition, and they're the times when the community gathers to talk together, to converse about issues that are difficult, challenging, controversial, and the point of them is to really try to come to some deeper collective understanding of these matters and to sustain one another in reflecting on what Christians, by virtue of the fact that they are Christians, ought to be thinking and seeing and feeling and acting about the matters set out before us. I'm going to, I understand we have a guest mouse here, who was supposed to have been on the panel actually, but has run off. I think we may have everybody over on this side of the room before the evening is over. So here's our situation. I'm going to read you the situation that we all find ourselves in. Some of you have read it, but I'm going to read it to you now and then introduce the panel. The tragic scene was no easier to bear or to comprehend simply because it had become all too familiar. Our small Iowa town had seen two young people killed and several more wounded by one of their own classmates in a violent rampage at the high school. After helping the community in the midst of shock, anger, and grief, the local pastoral conference moved to draft a plan to reduce the threat of violence to the community. They thought this would be a fairly easy task. It was not. They wound up with three resolutions and could not decide amicably among them. The first was offered by the Lutherans. It called for consolation and healing, including forgiveness for the murderer. It called for stricter enforcement of laws against vandalism, public intoxication, and possession of illegal firearms or drugs. It also called for stricter sentences for offenders, including life imprisonment for the young man who killed his classmates in cold blood. It also called for all adults in the community to be more involved with young people, helping to provide for community service projects for all high school students, as well as a larger athletic program that would allow all interested students to participate in competitive sports. Quote, "We can't eliminate human sinfulness," unquote, they said. "The task is to punish criminals and then encourage everyone else to become involved in constructive projects." Tonight, the Lutheran position will be elaborated by Pastor Dan. The second was offered by one of the many Bible churches. It called for a strenuous program of evangelism to win more souls for Christ, a covenant to eliminate alcohol and drug consumption, and a reintroduction of prayer into the public schools. It also called for the youth offender to be tried as an adult and, if convicted, be sentenced to death. Along with the Lutherans, it advocated teaching the appropriate use of violence to protect the innocent, as in the violence used by the police to stop the young man from killing even more students. Finally, it sought to focus on restoring and enriching the family and family values that are the very opposite of the values celebrated in the mass media. Quote, "The problem is to change human hearts. Men and women must change before a system can change," unquote. And the evangelicals will be represented by Pastor Dorothy. The third was offered by a coalition of Mennonites and others. It called for a total ban on all assault weapons and handguns. It offered programs to teach parents how to monitor TV watching and how to write to the networks protesting violence in the mass media. It encouraged non-competitive games and the teaching in Christian homes and in all churches of nonviolent resistance to evil as essential to a Christian way of life. They volunteered to teach a course in the public schools on techniques of nonviolent dispute resolution. And finally, they called upon the judiciary not to impose the death sentence on the prisoner, and they promised to visit him regularly. Quote, "There is no way to peace. Peace is the way," unquote. Now, I should say that the three panelists may or may not be representing views they actually hold. They're going to represent them as best they can. And once they finish their short 3-minute presentations, everybody is invited in to this conversation. So let's hear first from Pastor Dan.
Who's representing the third position?
Oh, I'm sorry, Pastor Gary. Did I leave Pastor Gary out? Thank you. Pastor Gary, to my immediate left, will be representing the third position. So we're going to hear from Pastor Dan and the Lutherans first.
Thank you. Lutheran stuff, and I put in one or two of my own opinions. But this is representing First Lutheran Church, which is on 501 Main Street. The spiritual leaders and Christian people of this community will continue a ministry of consolation to all who hurt because of this recent tragedy. We will care especially for the students, the injured, the families of the victims, and the families of the alleged perpetrator. We will stand with all, care for all, for the sake of the healing of this community. Understanding the heart of the gospel to be the forgiveness of sins in Christ, freely given for all, we believe this gift is for all, both the perpetrator of this crime and those who are bound by hatred and bitterness due to the tragedy. It is the power of God's mercy which will ultimately heal us. But at the same time, we support the police in the legitimate use of force, including the force used to keep the perpetrator from killing more students. Besides encouraging the police in their vocation of enforcing the law, we also encourage them in their efforts to establish friendships with the youth of our community. We also support the courts in their task of deciding guilt and sentencing. And if the alleged perpetrator is found guilty, we recommend life imprisonment for the sake of just punishment and for the protection of the innocent. However, we oppose the death penalty, which would hinder the condemned from receiving the forgiveness of sins. We call for strict and fair law enforcement, especially in relationship to laws concerning vandalism, underage drinking, and the possession of illegal firearms and drugs. As Christians, we pledge ourselves to be people of faith acting in love. With God's help, we will become more involved with the youth of this community through Big Sister and Brother programs. We will encourage counseling and help programs for troubled youth and youth addicted to alcohol and drugs. We will work for more youth community service projects and athletic programs to allow all interested youth to participate. We also encourage all students to be involved in the school conflict management program. For the sake of our youth, we pledge to nurture Christian faith in ourselves and our youth. We also pledge to live as examples of responsible citizenship, obeying the laws and working to change unjust laws. We cannot eliminate human sinfulness. We cannot bring in the kingdom of God, but we will do what we are called to do with God's forgiveness. Love our neighbors, support the curbing of sinfulness by the enforcement of just law, and by proclaiming the gospel, which has the power to heal this broken community. submitted on this day by First Lutheran Church, 501 Main Street.
Thank you, Pastor Dan. I know that many of you might have questions for Pastor Dan, but hold those until we've heard from our remaining two panelists, and we'll turn next to Pastor Dorothy.
Pastor Dan, I share your grief and about the tragedy that has caught our community, but I think that you're not getting to the root of the problem. Big brothers and big sisters, caring, understanding are not going to address the tragedy and the kind of situation that has developed, even in this small Iowa town, where the ways of New York and Chicago come to us every night on television, where our families are falling apart at rates as high as those throughout this nation, where the dissipation, I can only say, the moral decay of American society is far advanced, even though we look like a picture postcard small town. There's a root of the problem that must be addressed. One place that the problem is very clear is in the family. The young man who committed this crime, like so many young men in this society and even in our little town, have no male role models at home to look up to. They come from broken homes. The fathers have lost their ability to guide their families, and mothers have lost their ability to mother. They're out working. And I think that the dissolution of the family and the failure to guide children in that very basic institution is one of the causes of this problem. We have to address that if we're going to prevent episodes of this kind. As for the school, it doesn't surprise me that this violence should take place in school. What have schools become? A place where young people learn about sex, a place where when they misbehave, they're sent to counselors rather than expelled or punished, a place where they're given good grades to build their self-esteem, a place where morality and the guidance of adults for children has practically fallen apart. That's the way schools have become in our society, and I'm not surprised that violence should break out there. And why should they fear punishment? Now let's turn to the legal system, to the government. It is corrupt in some ways I need not mention, but even criminals have come to believe that they will get off on technicalities. Punishment does not necessarily surely follow a crime, even of this magnitude. The moral decay and permissiveness that is so evident in families and in schools, in fact, exists throughout the whole society, such that criminals feel that they have the upper hand. And it's not surprising to me, therefore, that with the failure of our community to unite under the word of God and under God's intention for human people, that this kind of episode should take place. What do we need to resolve? We need to resolve to support families, to do everything we can to keep fathers and mothers together, raising their children, their own children. Secondly, we need to make our schools places that honor the ways that God intends for people to live. We need prayer in the school. The children cannot even pray. I think that each school day should begin with the prayer, I would say the Lord's Prayer. And thirdly, we need for those who commit grievous crime to know that punishment will follow, that they are responsible, that this is to be a moral society, and immorality, particularly of this grievous kind, will be responded to with the force of the gathered community. And that means that when human life is taken in this irresponsible way, that we as a community have every right and have God's justice in mind when we claim that capital punishment is the only just response to this kind of crime.
Thank you. Again, hold your questions. I'm sure there are many. Until we've heard from our third panelist, Pastor Gary.
Okay. My argument is going to be rather simple. And since this is a religious coalition, and we should be approaching this from a religious perspective, which is Christian in all of our cases, I think we need to go to the gospel, and especially the Sermon on the Mount, which is the gospel within the gospel. In that document, which scholars tell us are the authentic words of Jesus, or at least his clear message, are very clear prescriptions for how we should be dealing with perpetrators of violence and what we should be doing for prevention of violence. I can just give you a few examples of pacifist statements from the early church, and my position is coming from the Christian pacifist tradition, which was what the early Christian church was for the first three centuries. Jesus was a pacifist. New Testament scholars all agree on that, whether they're conservative, liberal, or anywhere in between. And the Christian church understood Jesus to be nonviolent. His ethic was that of nonviolent love of friends and enemies. Is this child who is our neighbor to be cared for us is the question. How punitive shall be our punishment for perpetrators of violence? Jesus' ethic is clear, and that is we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. We are to love our enemies, not just, and enemies is plural in all cases where Jesus said it, and it is a command imperative. It is not a suggestion. It isn't written to be nice that you get a few capital punishment. It is a clear imperative command. If we, as Christians, and in our creeds, we understand that Jesus is the Messiah. Messiahship is a Jewish concept, but it means that if we claim someone to be the Messiah, we are to unconditionally obey that individual. And the Jews know that we really don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah because we do not give him unconditional obedience. And in the issue of violence, Jesus is very clear. Violence is forbidden for those who wish to follow him. That's a quote from the Bible. That is a clear message, and scholars, New Testament scholars, clearly understand that. Jesus, I think that Pastor Dorothy is a representative of the church that claims biblical inerrancy. And I think you should be following that. You should be consistent on that. And if Jesus says something to be true, then that should be what we should follow. Especially on issues as serious as violence, which is the most serious societal issue that we have, we need to follow his guidance. And so we shouldn't be spouting secular positions on this. We should be looking at what Jesus would say and do. There's a movement, I think it's mostly around among adolescent Christians, what would Jesus do? WWJD, I see that all over the place. We have to pretend that in this coalition that Jesus is here and we need to follow his lead. Again, he is not a biblical inerrantist. He said, you have heard that it was said of old, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you that you resist not evil with evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to the left also. You have heard it said of old, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them that despitefully use you, etc., etc., etc. The evidence in the New Testament is overwhelming. Jesus absolutely rejected violence. If we cannot know that Jesus absolutely rejected violence, we can know nothing of his mission or person. It's the clearest of teachings. And those scholars who understand the New Testament, how to interpret it, if we reject the nonviolent Jesus, then we have to reject virgin birth, the incarnation, the resurrection, everything. The evidence is so overwhelming that if we reject that, we also have to reject all these other dogmas in Christianity. So there's no question. Our churches, unfortunately, except the peace churches, which I represent in the Mennonite tradition, do not teach that. It's a dangerous concept in a community, a state that regards loving of enemies as treason. And that's in the U.S. Constitution. Supporting one's enemy in time of war is treasonous and subject to death. Jesus says, love your enemies. You can see the tension and why most churches would rather go with the flow, do as Romans do, just reject that clear teaching of Jesus. New Testament scholars, all schools of New Testament scholarship know that Jesus absolutely said, love your enemies. There's no question about that. In the rating of all those sayings, of the likelihood of Jesus' exact words, love your enemies, is right up there at the top. and we need to abide by that. We know in the story about the adulteress that was about to be stoned, Jesus absolutely rejected capital punishment. He stood between people who stoned, or wanted to stone the adulteress, and said, he was without sin or cast the first stone. So I could go into all the other evidence, and I have special interest and expertise in the psychology of violence, doing the understanding of why someone commits murder, why someone commits homicide of any sort, why people are wanting to do punitive legislation in our legislature, why we want blood, why we want revenge. But as Christians, if we say Jesus is Lord, then that implies that we are disciples of him. We need to follow his teachings and his actions.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think you have three very clear and articulate recommendations here for what we ought to be doing as Christians in view of this tragedy. And now we'd like to have some questions and comments of any one of the panelists or to one another. Where do you folks come out on this issue?
I'd like to ask, you said that we should have prayer in school and we would like the Lord's prayer in school. What do you do with the Jewish students, the Muslim students? How do you reconcile that?
Well, I think that's a question. Simply the fact that so many people take for granted that that's the right question shows how far we've come to relativism. That all these things are true and that we have to remove the basis on which our society is built. The Christianity, and I include the Judeo-Christian tradition in many ways, as the basis of our culture. And if we start to kind of kowtow to every religious group that comes along, I think that it will all be mush. And where will the young people find any guidance at all?
And you think Jesus would be proud of that?
Well, you know, the way, the truth, and the life. That's, you know, whosoever. No, I think that it's very important for young people, if they're going to walk the right path, to acknowledge that which is true. And I think that we can't be telling them that there's all these different options. So.
Would the Lutherans care to respond to that issue? Would you respond the same way?
No.
Nine. Am I to take it that, in a way, on this point, that there, if one is serious about being a Christian, there is a way to follow and discipleship? I think recommending here that we pray as Jesus prayed and recommending, as I heard you, that we act as Jesus would act. Is that a point on which you agree, or would you disagree as well with her position?
I think I agree with the prayer. Not that it should be coerced or forced prayer. I don't think coercion changes anybody's mind, really. It changes their external behavior, but it doesn't change their mind. And as soon as the coercion or the threat of whatever punishment is lifted, then nothing has changed. Jesus, the first words out of Jesus' mouth in the New Testament was, change your mind. Convert, not coercion. The difference between conversion and coercion is one of being convinced, one of being changing voluntarily. And coercion prayer is counterproductive and fraught with all sorts of problems. And I think a very peripheral issue to this controversy.
Could I add?
Yes, please.
It would be a major reason that I think it's an illusion that if we could only get kids praying in school, and that part of in our tradition is respecting, we have a foundation, of course, for this nation, respecting separation of church and state, that this is not appropriate.
One other comment I have about prayer, if I may, is St. John Chrysostom had extremely profound words of wisdom when he said, The test of the sincerity of one's prayer is the willingness to labor on its behalf. The test of the sincerity of one's prayer is the willingness to labor on its behalf. So when we pray for peace, but do nothing for peace or support structures and institutions that are contrary to the peace mission, we are being insincere in our prayers, and we could give a thousand other examples. But I think that's a very compelling statement.
Okay, if you don't mind, I see lots of hands up. Let's try to, I believe you said in passing that they were engaging on the prayer in public schools issue, something somewhat peripheral to this issue. So let's try to move close to the heart of what I heard as being a kind of fundamental disagreement. I heard the two of you indicate that you thought that there was a kind of legitimate use of violence, and that we saw it in this particular narrative at the point in which the police used violence to protect the innocent. And I heard you very clearly say that if we're serious about following Jesus as Christians, we simply have to renounce the use of violence for whatever reason, on whatever grounds.
For Christians, right.
And I would just like to invite not the three of you right now to continue this, but for others to just address that issue. And have you got anything to help us think through that conflict on either side of the issue? Affects how we treat the prisoner in this case, and affects all kinds of things. Yes.
You know, it's interesting. As Christians, certainly we can go with that guiding statement, what would Jesus do? But as Christians living in a world where there are many different faiths and many different understandings, and as someone who teaches in a public school, I'm concerned about the message that your position would send to students in general that who are not, quite frankly, capable of understanding the depth and everything of your position. That even though there are mice running around on the floor of this room, that while many would understand and support your position, that it would not work in an institution like a public high school, where not everyone is a Christian and not everybody should be coerced into being a Christian. That would be my concern.
Okay. That I think was sort of addressed to Pastor Gary, but I'd like to see if someone else would like to take up his point, namely that he teaches in a public high school, however much he might be persuaded by what Pastor Gary said, I think words were, this just wouldn't work for the Christians there. Anybody care to respond to that from a position similar to the one that Pastor Gary occupied? Before we ask Pastor Gary himself to respond.
I think that's a legitimate question, but it's also a legitimate question, does the use of violence to somehow stop violence, does that work? Seems to me that's been the answer for centuries, and the evidence is that the use of violence to stop violence does not produce peace, but it simply perpetuates and makes secular the whole ongoing violent process.
Okay, you have a point on this point about whether violence works or whether
I do. And also tying in Pastor Gary's point of the three opinions expressed, Pastor Gary made a clear statement that folks here should not become involved in secular matters. And I heard Pastor Dan and Pastor Dorothy express positions that really call the church, calling their parishioners to become involved in secular matters. So the issue of legitimized violence and the state being able to perpetrate violence for the protection of the community, that seems very much a secular matter and not a religious matter.
I think Pastor Gary would like to respond, because I'm not sure that you heard him correctly.
Yeah. Well, the traditional Mennonite position, the Mennonites came out of the Anabaptist movement, which was the left wing of the Reformation. The Lutherans and Reformed came out of the right wing of the Reformation, pro-war, pro-justified violence, basically, and left wing was no justification for violence. And they have extremely strong backing for that, from the gospel and what the early 300 years of Christianity was all about. Later Mennonite positions are much more active in society. Mennonite I can't remember the title, but they have extremely active resistance to evil in society and around the world. And so they are not any longer, although they started out that way, and the Hutterites and the Amish are still uninvolved in secular matters, but the Mennonites are not. So we are not uninvolved, but we are trying to be the leaven in the human dough of history. Where is it said that Christians shouldn't follow Jesus until the rest of the world follows Jesus? It doesn't say that anywhere. We're not supposed to wait until the rest of the world follows Jesus and does what Jesus does. It says what Jesus says. We're supposed to be the leaven in the human dough of history. And here's the perfect spot to do it. Blessed are the merciful, blessed are the peacemakers, and the ethic of nonviolent love of friends and enemies, and the use of the power of love, Christic love, from satanic vengeance and violence. Yeah. Violence just begets violence.
Thank you. So the position here is that the Christians involve themselves in the secular world, but on Christian terms, as understood and outlined by Pastor Gary. This gentleman over here has suggested that may be well and good, but it wouldn't work in his high school. This gentleman has said that does violence work any better? And we have someone else who wants to get in on that. Barbara Russell.
Well, I just wanted to say, I think that there's a whole spectrum of options here, and I really hear your concern that it's hard to start in the schools right now, but I guess here I'll just do a little commercial on behalf of Lutheran Peace Fellowship that I work with. Which I invite you all to consider joining, the Fellowship of Reconciliation. 20 Nobel Peace Prize laureates have just issued a call for the millennium year, the year 2000, to be a year of education for nonviolence, and the first 10 years to be a decade. I mean, I think we really, as a society, have to move together towards starting to teach the ways of peacemaking in the same way we school one another in, you know, things like arithmetic and stuff. I mean, it's something that can be learned. And I agree with you that you can't just sort of start all, you know, change our ways. But I think there are tools in the churches for learning nonviolence and for learning strategies of conflict resolution and peacemaking. The Fellowship of Reconciliation has a big peace institute starting in a couple weeks in Indiana. The Other Side magazine is having one in September. I mean, I think the more we can do to teach peacemaking through organizations like the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, that's the only way we can transform. And I had a totally unrelated thing I wanted to mention in a second, but if I may, that I think another issue that needs to be raised on these the shootings in the schools is the issue of gender. That we live in a culture that specifically targets a great deal of its violence against women and children, and in many of the shootings, specifically in the Jonesboro one, it was quite clear that the boy children, said they were going to shoot girl children. I want to kill every girl that's ever broken up with me, was Mitch Johnson's words. And I think there's the whole gender dimension that Pastor Dorothy, the problem with supporting a sort of patriarchal culture that I think is part of what you're talking about is that patriarchy has been, in part, what is supported violence against women. And I think there's a complex range of issues that are at work in this question.
Thank you. Okay, lots of others want to get in. Now I saw your hand first, then we'll come to you, and then we'll look over here. So, Joel?
I'm frankly disappointed that I don't hear any of you addressing what I think is the kinds of violence that are at a deeper level that contributed to this situation. In particular, my feeling that the person who perpetrated this themselves is a victim of violence, and that so often in these situations, if one were to go back and probe into that person's history, there's a tremendously violent history in terms of abuse in the family and that sort of thing. And I frankly don't hear any of you dealing with those deeper societal issues really, I think, undergird. I heard Pastor Dorothy talking about the family, but again, in a very what I think is a patriarchal way that contributes to some of the kinds of abuse that we often see. So I guess I'd like to hear more, I'd like to hear the churches dealing more deeply with this at a whole different level, a deeper level.
Okay, and we'll put one more thing on the table, and then we will hear from the panel on the issue of the patriarchy, which has come up twice, the gender issue, and the deeper sources of violence here, this perpetrator probably having been a victim of it himself. So your point.
Right. Okay, first of all, violence is learned, it's programmed. And the other thing, why we have this, like dealing with the schools and the high schools, et cetera, like how do we deal with that violence in a non-violent way and in the real world? And why it seems like an impossibility at times is because we haven't been taught, we haven't learned all the various varieties of ways of responding in the real world. And that's something that we need to like explore, all these other ways, which is like opening up a whole new universe. It's not limiting, it's actually opening up. Now to deal with this kind of like real world type situations, the causations, the roots of it, how to respond to various forms of violence in schools, out on the streets, it is like through institutional violences, how can the police even respond to it in a more humane way, and et cetera. Well, there are organizations out in the world now who are actually addressing these various issues and coming up with alternative ways to respond to them, such as Peace Bros Incorporated. They go to police departments and go into these various issues in real world situations. They're now teaching in high schools and elementary schools, teaching even the teachers on alternatives to violence. And this is rapidly spreading throughout, for instance, the state of Ohio in the public educational system. And it's spreading so well that even the University of Cincinnati, through the College of Education, and more specifically in the Board of Education, they are now teaching new teachers the alternatives to violence and COVID, and teaching in kids, not say just getting into religiosity, but getting into their world will and how to respond to this. So I'm saying the means are also there. We need to start exploring it and incorporate it.
Thank you. So could you identify yourself with your name?
Ray Estes.
Okay, I'm just asking him because you can talk to Ray to get the name of some of those organizations he mentioned. If after the forum you're wondering what organization might come and help to educate the police and others in these matters. And then Barb Rossing up there mentioned the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and other folks here at the Village would know about that. But we're going to come now to this issue of patriarchy and gender and why it is that the three panelists apparently have that in common, that none of them addressed that particular issue. And so we should give each of them, I think we'll begin with the Lutheran, whose one response has been, I think the word no so far, to see whether he has anything to say about it.
I had in working on this whole thing, I was aware that I think a mainline church like the Lutheran Church would maybe have its doctrine somewhat together of grace if it's a Lutheran church. And Joel really brought up that I think what the problem is, and we kind of, and I purposely kind of came up with all the old solutions. Let's just have a better Big Brother Big Sister program, and let's. I don't know, what else do I say? Support the police, you know, and then what that really does, and support a better athletic program in an after school. And notice how often I use the word program. And what I kind of purposely did as a reminder is really turn the really deep, some of the deepest questions over to the Bible Church. You know, and that is the crisis of the American family, the violence in the American family. And we tend to have some of the old program. Am I right if you're from Iowa? Mm-hmm. We tend to have just some of the old program answers. and then we turn over to, when I heard Dorothy's talking, it says, right, she is moving into where we don't, we tend not to dare move. And that is to the really hard questions of the American family and the permeation of violence in the whole family structure and system and male.
You want to say something, Pastor Dorothy?
Yes, I don't understand this word patriarchy, but I assure you that I deplore child abuse and boys killing girls, men killing women, just every bit as much as you do. I just think that the safest, the way to raise children who know the good of one another, boys who respect girls, men who respect women, who protect them and care for them, is to do it in stable families where mothers can develop their maternal qualities, where fathers will care for their families. Really, and you know that this, and that when we find out about child abuse in our churches, we do something about it too. But I don't think you'd find, I say this with every hat on, I don't think you'd find the incidence to be greater in one religious group over another. And we're taking the rap here. But we care about families, and come to our church and we'll help your marriage to stay together. We won't take it for granted that you can split up if you want to. And we'll get your young people involved in wholesome activities and teach them to respect one another across the gender lines.
I beg to differ. The statistics will say that the more conservative or more right-wing or more fundamentalist churches do have a higher incidence of child abuse. And child abuse is not just physical or sexual. It's also verbal, emotional, spiritual. It's neglect, abandonment as well. But for fundamentalist religions who believe that the Bible is inerrant, they jump into Proverbs that says, use, spares the rod, spoils the child, which is dogma in those religions. I have to say that truth. And the amount of physical abuse is very high, and it isn't in the peace churches. It isn't Mennonites. That's dogma that you do not beat your child. You do not. But in the more right wing, the more fundamentalist, the higher incidence of child abuse, and the psychological aspects of abuse, whether it's just being cold shouldered or mean or threatened with hellfire and brimstone, you know, for little minor infractions, that has serious psychological consequences later in life. The incidence of schizophrenia in childhood is much higher in fundamentalist churches than in other churches. You can sort of understand sort of a schizophrenic kind of child rearing. You know, Jesus loves you, but you're going to go to hell. You know, and whippings, et cetera, are very, very common. I'm sure that you don't do it and you don't condone it, but it's happening in patriarchal, male-dominated societies where that sort of come out of a system where it's actually condoned, and instead we have to get rid of this willful child. Children are evil, and they need to be whipped. I was on the mailing list of a fundamentalist church in my town. I don't know how I got on it. I think someone was trying to convert me, probably. And the stuff that was in there about child rearing was just horrifying. It sort of resembled the 16th century stuff, you know, about beating your children, getting the willfulness out of it. And the psychological consequences are tremendous. For the children, for men who wind up on death row, it's 95%+ have been statistically abused as children. Maximum security prisoners, 95%+ have been statistically abused as children. Prostitutes are 80% sexually abused as children. You know, I could go on and on with statistics. It's just horrifying. Multiple personality disorders are 100% sexually and or physically abused, usually both, and it goes on for years. You know, this are not genetic stuff. It's brain chemical, because violence causes change in your neurotransmitters. And for people whose brains aren't hardwired until they're 10, and they're plastic, and every violence, every neglect, every abuse has its terrible long-term effects on the forms of depression, anxiety, you know, you name it. Attention deficit disorder, I'm quite certain, in large proportions, has a lot to do with family violence. These kids are watching, doing Mortal Kombat on their Nintendo games with horrible, horrible
blood and deaths and beheadings, and every kid has a Nintendo. And do we think and wonder why our kids are violent? I mean, it's obvious. It's a multitude of factors, but it ain't genetic, I guarantee you. It's environmental. It's not all harsh parenting. It's not all brutality in the home. It's a combination of things, the cruel school hallways, you know, the teasing, the humiliation, the shaming, anything that decreases one's empathy. I like to call this the process of extinction of empathy. Kids who kill other kids have no empathy for them. We know that. And, the causes are legion. But nonviolence is the prevention. You know, and one of the problems is that we profess in the media and the psychiatric industry even to not know, well, why did someone do that? Must have snapped, you know? And the media doesn't help us explain it either. We don't know the details of this child, and until we do, we can't make any judgments. We should not make any judgments until we have the facts, and the facts are kept from us for reasons.
Okay. Thank you. It sounds to me at least that the panelists and a number of people who've spoken agree that one key to this is the family, but we disagree then on exactly what kind of family, what manner of treatment, what structure, et cetera, et cetera. So anybody, I believe this gentleman back here from Cal Lutheran asked a question a long time ago, and I've heard some responses, a question back to you, does violence work any better? And then a number of folks who've offered different agencies and so forth who might participate in education and creating a different culture there. Have you been yet convinced, or would you like to come back with some of these folks?
Well, I let me tell you that I teach an advanced placement class that basically stops at May 19th. And let me tell you what I've done since then. We've learned about Gandhi. We've learned about Mandela and Biko in South Africa. I leave Martin Luther King for their U.S. history teacher, but I mean, I think there are teachers out there doing that, and be one of those people that does. I'm all for that. But I also have served as an assistant principal for summer school, and I know that there are students in our schools who, if given a clear playing field, which is how they would see it, if you could do these things, they would go ahead and do it. And I think what that takes us back to is a lot of the good discussion we had about the root causes. And that is clearly the areas that need to be addressed. But as far as having a consequence-free playing field in these kinds of situations in the real world of a public high school today, I fear that still wouldn't work. While agreeing with the sentiment that says attack the root causes.
Are there any other villagers here who, like this gentleman, are out there on the front lines in different institutions who think that, however much they may be persuaded about this ethic, there would be just a very tough time living it out in those places? Yes?
I teach in an elementary school, and the kids know these nonviolent techniques that you're talking about. It's whether or not they're willing to choose to use those. In 8 years, I'll bet I've seen a dozen of these programs going on, coming through. And the kids can tell you exactly, word for word, what you've taught them about it. That doesn't mean that when they get in a situation, they're going to react in an appropriate way, which goes back to the basics, the
home situation.
That's right.
Yeah.
Ma'am, you're nodding vigorously.
Well, because I teach in an elementary school also, third grade, and like John said, a lot of these programs come through and we've been teaching them for years and years. And the kids do know all the answers. And I guess I'm to the point where I'm tired of all these programs. I don't want any more. I don't want to have to teach them again and again and again, because I really don't feel that they're doing any good, because they're not seeing this in their homes. And no matter what we teach at school in the 5 or 6 hours a day that we have them, and we teach, oh, Project Charlie or Peaceful Partners or whatever it is, for a half an hour a week or even a half an hour a day, which would be stretching it, you can't do what they see the rest of the time. You can't overshadow that in that length of time, what they go on to.
Did you hear that?
Could I be just...
Yes, Pastor Dan, please, yes. I think it's time for the panelists to just be themselves. Not that Gary hasn't done a good job of that already.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear this from teachers because where we live on the island, they have very strong programs of reconciliation circles and reconciling students that have been taught to be the key. And then to hear teachers saying, oh. And I'm really compelled by Walter Wink in Engaging the Powers, where he said we have to admit, and that's where none of us on this were ready to say this. It would be, you know, that just as a whole society, the adults that are wishing young people would be less violent. Mm-hmm. We as a nation believe in a religion of redemptive violence, meaning violence is a way to solve problems. Violence is a way to reestablish order. Walter Wink says it's a restoration of ancient Babylonian Marduk religion, which is our national creed, and it is perpetuated in the media, it is perpetuated in homes, families, Nintendo games, comic books. And the amount of influence that teachers have, or the small little amount of influence that we in the church and Sunday school, we don't have a chance. And Walter Wink says that in all the history of religion, this religion of redemptive violence has the most amazing and effective catechetical program ever invented. So what chance do you have? That's what I...
And then as a classroom teacher, we're told, but don't touch that child. Mm-hmm. You know, keep your hands off. And and for a lot of the kids, this is the only secure place that they have to come. Mm-hmm. And they want that pat on the back or a little hug once in a while. And yet that's the very thing that, you know, we aren't to that point yet in where I teach. But I've always said when we get to that point, I'm going to have to quit because I can't do it any other way.
Mary.
Well, but I hate to give up on this. I mean, Dan, you say we teach it in our church and Sunday school. I never got that in my church and Sunday school as a kid. I was never given an option to violence until I was an adult.
Yeah.
And I think the Lutheran Church doesn't, frankly, your position was so wishy-washy, I couldn't tell. I don't think we have laid out options for our young people or our adults in our church. You very rarely hear a pastor talking, preaching about nonviolence. You very seldom have it in Sunday school. I mean, if the church and Sunday school were strong and if the teachers continued to do it, at least kids have been given some kind of option. They might not always choose it because, you know, the world is, the evil is so powerful, but I think we would really be remiss if we didn't lay out the option at least for them.
Yeah, no.
Yes, sir.
I think it's interesting, we get these three pastors talking about violence, but the problem is they all represent religion, which really believes in a God of violence, a God who required Abraham to kill his son, who required wiping out villages when they took a promised land, all through the scriptures, and then the Christians come along, and God requires the killing of his only son in order to satisfy his anger as a propitiation, this idea of an atonement where God has to be satisfied by the act of violence. I think the churches for 2,000 years have been caught up in perpetuating a whole understanding of life that's grounded in a God who is himself violent, herself violent. And I think the church has to start with its own understanding before it even gets out there to talking about society. We make these nice phrases, but we don't deal with our own whole system, rationale, theology, violence.
Well, Jesus revealed a God that was merciful, all-loving, forgiving. Jesus, you know, all through the history of religion, the Christian, Jewish religion, God's voice came through prophets.
and it was a succession, it was sort of an evolution, and pretty soon they got to Amos and they're talking about justice, and then they got to Isaiah and they talked about the suffering servant, and him was the suffering servant Isaiah. And the people didn't get it. They're still justifying wars, and finally he sent his son. This is my personal theology, which is relevant. Finally he sent his son to reveal his nature, and he said, God is love. And love, in the New Testament, is agape. And there's 330 times that love is used in the New Testament. And love had three meanings in Greek, or according to Greek that the New Testament was written. It has agape, which is unconditional love, a friend and enemy, willingness to suffer without the desire for retaliation, the willingness to love and serve without reciprocation. And then it had philia, brotherly, sisterly love, and then it had eros. Eros was the average, everyday word for love. Love of a hamburger, love, sexual love, it's romantic love. And our everyday word for love in English is equivalent to eros. We don't even have a word for agape. And in the New Testament, 95% of the time love is used as agape, 5% as philia. Eros is never used in the New Testament, never. Our everyday word for love is never used in the New Testament, so we're talking a different language. So when God is love, God is unconditional love, God is nonviolent, Jesus obviously taught that ethic. And so he revealed God of nonviolence. And so when we interpret, when we see the contradictions between the Old Testament violence, which is highly justified, and New Testament, and regarding violence, we have to go with what Jesus said. He's the Son of God and Messiah. We don't go with what Samuel said.
Okay, back here.
It's bothered me as I listen that it seems that any use of force, any imposition of structure, for whatever purpose, might be construed as violence. To the extent that is done out of hate, out of malice, I would be very comfortable classifying that as violence. To the extent it's done with a loving, helpful purpose, as these teachers have spoken to, I cannot in any way construe it as violence. Jesus did cleanse the temple. I don't believe he did it in hate, but those watching could very well have construed it in violence, yet I do believe he went about it in love because it was the only way to gain the attention of those involved and deliver a message.
About the cleansing of the temple, that's the one justification that 95% of Christians have used to say, oh, Jesus was violent, wasn't he? In the Koine Greek of the New Testament, there's no instance where it's described that Jesus used violence against humans. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he didn't even have the whip of cords. He overturned the tables. In John, that's the only place where the whip of cords is used, and he only used it on the animals. He was saving those animals by whipping them out of the temple. They were the sacrificial animals. So that was an act of love. The reason we think that was an act of violence is because the Renaissance painters loved to paint that scene. They didn't know Greek. They didn't know nonviolent. They didn't know the nonviolent Jesus. They painted Jesus as a muscular with a whip and people cowering. So
I don't think that the two of you are in a way quite as far apart. I mean, I understood you to be saying that I don't think you're against structures of any kind. I think that basically you're against what I understood him to be against, which is structures that are finally grounded in and thrive on violence. So I in a way, don't think that you're that far apart. And in a way, though, I think we're not all of one mind. We have come to 9:30, and we try to honor that 1 hour. I would just like to observe that here we took a small case, which we have experienced as a nation many times over, and that might happen in our own communities next week. And as Christians, notice how we got very quickly to some very fundamental things when you lift up the issue of violence. The very character of the God that we worship and adore came up itself, and you can't get much more fundamentally theological than that, as this gentleman brought up his point of the God of the Bible, and he responded. We came up with the very structure of the family. We came up with the whole question of what works and what doesn't and how relevant that issue ought to be. And we came up, as Dan said, with a fundamental point of departure in all Christian social criticism, which is that it begins with us, and as he suggested, look at our own hearts, how deeply we're implicated in what he called the structures of redemptive violence, and then moves out from there to all of these other thoughts and concerns. So here, this issue of violence really got us all quickly together down to about as fundamental a set of issues and questions that Christians could possibly address and think through together. Now, obviously, that thought is going to have to continue after this hour, but thanks so much to the panelists who, remember, were role-playing, and one of them in particular, well, not to mention her name, said that she wanted that made clear again at the end. So thank you all for coming, and thank you all for your wisdom and contributions, and we'll continue this after the forum adjourns. Good night. One more plug to a great book, and then we're...